Well, good morning. As you know, we're in the book of Exodus. So if you'll be finding your way there, we'll be looking at the entirety of chapter 5 this morning. While you're finding your place, I want to ask you a question. And you're going to need to help me out with discussing this for a few minutes. Do you look forward to conversations that you know you're going to have that are uncomfortable? I mean, you know trouble is brewing, and eventually something's going to have to be dealt with. Do you look forward to those kind of situations? I don't think probably anyone does. And the way people handle those things is, there's a wide spectrum of how you deal with those kinds of things. When Susan and I were first married, our approach to dealing with unpleasant things was, at the end of the spectrum. She was on one end, I was on the other. You know, she had the tendency to, as you could probably kind of guess what our approaches were before I tell you, but on her end of the spectrum, it was just, you know, close your eyes and maybe it'll go away. You know, just don't talk about it now. Let's don't think about it. We'll deal with it later. And suddenly, later is here, you know. My approach was, there's a mosquito, where's my sledgehammer? You know, to kill the mosquito with a sledgehammer approach and just blow everything up. Well, over the years, we've kind of met in the middle somewhere. Thankfully, I have mellowed out a little bit. That's a compliment to me for sure. And she has changed as well. And I've noticed, in fact, I was thinking this past week as I was thinking through this, I've noticed, looking back, I can see that in the last number of years, we've had a number of incidents where, you know, something's going to be unpleasant. You know, something is, we can see, you know, the proverb says the wise man foresees the evil coming, you know, and you can see trouble is brewing. You know, you know something is coming. And a number of times, she has beat me to the solution. You know, she will say, you know, and sometimes it'll be something where she needs to do the talking, not me, or I may need to do the talking in some situations. But, you know, she'll come and say, here's how I think, you know, what I should say. Here's what I think we should do or I should do in this situation. And it's a lot better than I would have come up with. And I, you know, looking back on it, I think that she has learned, I've got to get this figured out before he messes it all up, you know, before he blows things apart. I better, you know, kind of get a step ahead here. So that's kind of, you know, the way things are. You know, you come across situations that happen, and you know they've got to be dealt with. You know you can't ignore it, but, you know, you've got to figure out, what do I do? Moses is kind of in that situation. You know, he was in the wilderness and God told him to go back and lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. In so doing, he's got to deal with Pharaoh. God told him that Aaron is on his way, your brother is on his way to meet you. And you remember the account of how Aaron's going to be the spokesman and because Moses thinks he can't speak very well. So the day comes when Moses and Aaron meet. They meet in the wilderness. And Moses tells Aaron, here's what God told me. Here's what's going on. God told me to lead the children of Israel out. God said that he would give authority to what I will say through various signs. And I'm sure he told Aaron what had happened with the rod and with the leprous hand in his bosom. I don't know that the text tells us, I don't think it tells us that he showed Aaron the signs. He just told Aaron what had happened. At least he told him what had happened. And so now they are there, and it's time to go back to Egypt. Surely they had this conversation. Where do we start? What should we say? If you had been there, if you had been either Moses or Aaron or was with them, what would you have suggested? How would you have thought it would have been wise to deal with this? Let me ask you, narrow the questions down a little bit. Do you think that you should go and talk to the leaders of the Israelites first? Think that would be a good idea? Come on, y'all think. Yes, there we go. I think so. Because if you go to Pharaoh and he says, okay, take off, and then you go to the Israelites and say, hey, we're free to go, we don't want to go anywhere. You know, you got to know that they're behind you, right? You got to know that you're on the same page with them. So that's where you start, I would think. Start with the children of Israel and make sure that everybody's on the same page here, so when we're ready to go, we're ready to go. And so you accomplish that, hopefully. If they are unwilling or if they're resistant, then you probably need to stay at that point until you get that ironed out, perhaps. That would be kind of how I would be thinking. And then you go to, at some point, you got to go to Pharaoh. And that's another different colored horse, isn't it? You don't really know what's going to happen. This is a new Pharaoh. The old one is dead and gone. You've been gone for 40 years. And so the new fellow is on the throne. So what do you tell him? Do you come demanding? Do you speak hatefully to him? Or do you beg and plead? Do you ask permission? Do you offer him something? I mean, what do you do? So I'm sure Moses and Aaron are having a conversation like this. Now, in our text this morning, you'll see on your outline, I've got, and it's on both pages, five what I'm calling appeals. Five appeals, and then what happens after those appeals. What's the response of the person who is being appealed to? So let's look at, listen, appeal number one. This is what Moses and Aaron decide. We can see back in the last two or three verses of chapter 4 that John dealt with this last week. Moses and Aaron go back. They do talk to the children of Israel. And I want you to look at what they say. Right? Verse 28. So Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him, and all the signs which he had commanded him. This is Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. I don't know who these people are. I don't know how many it is. It's estimated that there are 2 million Israelites that went across the wilderness from Egypt to Canaan. I'm sure he didn't meet with 2 million people. I'm sure he didn't meet with 100,000 people. Maybe 1,000, maybe 500. I don't know who he met with. I don't know how they determined who he was going to meet with. But he met with them, it says in verse 29. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. So here apparently God allows him to show it. And I don't doubt, if I had been there, I would have said, hey, you got to show me. You know, show me the signs if you say this is what God's going to do. And God allowed that. God did that. He showed the signs to the people. Verse 31. So the people believed. Now we're going to, I want you to look at some verbs here. So the people believed. How do you think Moses and Aaron feel about that? Relief. They feel great. Things are going well. The people believed when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, that he had looked upon their affliction. So what has God done? God has visited, is the verb, and God has looked. comforting word. You know, when you have, as a child, when you have a bad issue going on, it's good to know, and I guess it depends on the circumstance, but it's good to know that when you look and see that your parent sees your peril. It's good to know that you can look and somebody has paid attention. Somebody is watching. Somebody is ready to help you. This is what the idea is in my mind. The Lord looked upon their affliction. God knows. It's not just that he knows the facts. He knows and is moving. Goes on to say, what happens then? How do the children of Israel respond? Do they have a big celebration party? Do they say yay? Probably not. Look what it says, they bowed their heads and worshiped. What a fitting response. It's not just a fickle moment of happiness. They bow their head and worship. So then we get to chapter 5, verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh. This is the first appeal. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. Now there's the appeal. Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh, and they tell him, God said this. That's the first thing that we want to notice. That they make it clear to Pharaoh that they're speaking what God has told them. This is not our idea. God is the one who said this. Now, that should make a difference, shouldn't it? It should make a difference. Another thing that we need to remember is that it's implied through all of this whole story that the Israelites are not free to just leave. If they were, why is he coming and asking? 200 or 300 years ago, 400 years ago, the Israelites came to Egypt in a favored position. They were treated well. They had the choice of the fertile ground to a farm and to live on. But things have changed. I don't know how they changed, but somehow they have changed, and now they are enslaved. They are not free to leave. That's why they're asking them to pay the debt. But that's not a problem to me. You know how far it is from the land of Goshen to Canaan? As the crow flies, I think it's 4,500 miles. The route they would have to take is like 700 or 800 miles. Alright? How long is it going to take them if they are unhindered? How long will it take them to get there? A while. They've been walking. 2 million people walking. So it'll take a while. Is that where they're headed? Is that where they think they're going? Is that where you think they're going? Is that where Moses is coming to take them? But so, isn't it? God told them I was going to lead my children, my people, out of Egypt and carry them to the land that I promised to give you. That's where I thought they were going. What's unusual in this first verse that doesn't seem to fit? Says this, let my people go. He doesn't say so they can go back to the land God promised them 400 miles away or 700 or what it is. Doesn't say that. He says, let my people go so they can go hold a feast in the wilderness. And I read that and I think, what? That's not really what they're doing. Is it? Is that what they're doing? Just going to the desert and having a worship service? And to me, it's implied that, and then we'll be back. Now maybe I maybe I'm reading something they don't know to read, but that's what it, maybe what it seems like. I thought they were going to Canaan. They are. They're going to Canaan. Isn't that where they end up? That's where they're headed. They eventually get there. Everybody knows that's where they're headed. But they tell Pharaoh, let us go so we go into the desert and have a festival, a worship festival to God. Now, why that is presented that way, I don't know. I don't know. There's a little saying that goes like this. When a half-truth is told as the whole truth, it becomes an untruth. I'll tell you, that seems like to me that's what that is. They're not telling the whole thing. They're not telling Pharaoh we don't have any intentions of coming back here. Why that is the way it was done, I don't know. But I do know in a sense. It was done that way because that's exactly what God told them to say. Okay, this is not some thing that Aaron and Moses made up. Okay, turn back to chapter 3 and verse 18. Look at verse 17 to start with. This is God talking to Moses when he's in the wilderness and God's still dealing with him about going and leaving them out. Verse 17, and I have said, this is God talking, I will bring you up out of affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites to a land flowing with milk and honey. This is not in the desert. This is in Canaan. Then, verse 18, they will heed your voice and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him. Here's what he's telling them to say. They don't have to figure out what to say. He's telling them what to say. The Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. He says, I'm going to lead you to Canaan. But here's what you tell Pharaoh. God has come and God has said, let my people go 3 days' journey into the wilderness to worship. Now, I'm going to have to leave that right there. Okay, I don't know why God did that way, but he did. And what God does is right. What God does is right. Now, I'm going to suggest one thing that I think God may be accomplishing in this toward the end of the sermon. And if I forget, remind me. Okay, we're going to kind of come back to this in a little bit. All right, what response did they get? This is the response to this first appeal. They appealed to Pharaoh just saying, let us go. Let us go to the wilderness and worship. How does Pharaoh respond? Verse 2. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? Who is this God you're talking about? Is Pharaoh an atheist? I don't think so. I think Pharaoh's got more gods than he knows what to do with. All right? The Nile River is a god. All these other things are gods. We're going to see that God talks to him about his gods and the plagues a little bit. But Pharaoh's not an atheist. But he has an incomplete or a just outright false idea of God. Because he... it feels like he can determine whether or not he's going to do what God said. It feels like he's going to decide for himself about this God. Who is the Lord? Who is this God? He says, I don't know the Lord, your Lord that they're talking about, nor will I let Israel go. So there's his response. I don't know your Lord. You're not leaving. I'm not going to let you go. So then we come to appeal number two. They ask him again with a little more information. So they said, verse 3, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. So what's different about this appeal than the first? They give him a little more information about the 3 days' journey, about their what they have in mind. And then they appeal to him for their own safety's sake. They're saying, in essence, if we don't do this, God may kill us. God may punish us severely if you don't let us do what God has told us to do. They're appealing to his compassion. They're appealing to his mercy, his sense of mercy. That's the second appeal. What's his response to that appeal? Well, it's kind of long, verses 4 to 14. But you'll get the gist of it in verse 4. Then the king of Israel said to them, Moses and Aaron. I thought it was interesting he called them by name. Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Now here, he's getting a little bit to the gist of what bothers him about this whole thing. Why are you taking these people from their work? If they go out into the desert, a 3 days' journey, they're going to be gone a week or two or whatever, and no work is going to be done. Why do you take them from their work? And then he turns back with a command to them, get back to your labor. Go back to work. Get busy. And then I assume they left, and then Pharaoh continues his response in this way. Pharaoh said in verse 5, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. He's still talking to Moses and Aaron. So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, say, Pharaoh is fixing to change his orders. Here's what he says. You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. So the Israelites were slaves. They were in the business of making bricks for Pharaoh. Pharaoh provided the raw materials, or at least the straw. He provided the raw materials for them to make the bricks, and so they made the bricks. But now he says, you're not going to provide the straw any longer. They're going to have to get their own straw. And, verse 8, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. They still got to make the same number of bricks that they did before. They've got to get the same amount accomplished, but they've got to get their own raw materials. You should not reduce it. And he comes across this word. He says this word 3 or 4 times. For they are idle. They're idle. They're not doing anything. Because they're idle, they cry out saying, let us go sacrifice to our God. In other words, Pharaoh is saying, if they had their mind on their work, if they were so consumed with their work, they wouldn't have time to think about the sacrifice stuff. We'll get them busy enough. We'll put their knee to or their hand to the plow. We'll work them so hard enough that they won't have time to think about going. All they want to do when they get off of work is go to bed. Because tomorrow is a new day and it's coming quick. And it's more of the same. Verse 9. Let more work be laid on the men that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. I suppose that that's a reference to Moses and Aaron. Let them work, and next time somebody comes along with all this talk about going to the desert to worship, they'll won't be so quick to listen. They won't be so ready to go along with it. Verse 10, and the taskmasters of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go get yourselves straw where you can find it. Yet none of your work will be reduced. So they're passing on the same information, right? Verse 12, so the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. Now, I'm not sure what that means. They're supposed to put straw in the brick. They go out to gather, and it says they gather stubble instead of straw. Now, stubble, I thought, would have been the bottom cutting, just the right above the root of the plant. Around in Arkansas, when you see farmers grow wheat, especially wheat, it's real obvious. And once the wheat is cut and harvested, you see this short stubble of wheat, about 3 or 4 inches long, across the field. I suspect what has happened is the children of Israel have gathered the straw, and they still don't have enough, and so they're desperate enough to not have to travel for 100 or 200 miles to try to find some that they may not even exist there either, that they are getting the leftovers and cutting this straw down to the nubs. I mean, getting every little thing that 3 weeks ago wouldn't have been worth bothering, all of a sudden it is now. Perhaps that's what it is. Verse 13, and the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, fulfill your work, your daily quotas, as when there was straw. Number 14, also the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them. Now here we get a new piece of information about the way this is set up. Pharaoh has his taskmasters. They have appointed Israelite men as, you might say, foremen or superintendents over their own people. So you have the Pharaoh's taskmasters are in charge of the Israelite officers. The Israelite officers are in charge of smaller groups of Israelite workers. So the Pharaoh's taskmasters go to the officers of the Israelites, and that's where they carry their orders to. And verse 14 says, the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and asked, why have you not fulfilled your task in making brick both yesterday and today as before? Okay, so I would assume, it sounds like, that Pharaoh's taskmasters have gone to the right place. If things are not being accomplished, if not enough bricks are being made, they're going to go to the officers first. And they're going to demand an explanation from them. Not only do they demand it, they beat them, punish them for not doing what was required of them. So all of that is the response to this appeal. Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh and ask that they might go in the wilderness and worship. Pharaoh responds, not just no, but he responds by punishing the children of Israel and forcing them to produce even more and even more. Appeal number 3, verses 15 and 16. The officers of the children of Israel come to Pharaoh. So these Israelite officers who are over in charge of all the people who were just beaten, they somehow gain an audience with Pharaoh. And they come to Pharaoh and they ask him this question. Why are you dealing with your servants in this way? Why are you treating us this way? Verse 16, there was no straw given to your servants, and they say to us, make brick. And indeed, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people. Now, this is an interesting response. It's correct to a point. The fault is in Pharaoh. That will be where the buck stops, wouldn't you think? All right? But they come to Pharaoh and they say, listen, and surely they know Pharaoh is aware of all this. Surely they know Pharaoh's the one that gave the original orders, but they're presenting it like he may not know what's going on. They said, we are being beaten for something that's not our fault. We were making brick, and now we can't meet the quota because you piled more work on us than we could possibly do. So how does Pharaoh respond to that? Verse 17, he said, here's this word again, you are idle. You're idle. People aren't working. You're idle. Therefore, you say, let us go sacrifice to God. The same thing. Pharaoh seems to be consumed with this idea of the only reason they're thinking of doing this kind of stuff is because they don't have, they're not, their mind's not on their work. Right, verse 18, now therefore go now and work, for no straw will be given you, yet you shall deliver the quota of bricks. So their response is the same. Nothing changes. You're not going to get any relief from me. And they know they're in trouble. They know that this is not going to work. So they leave. All right? And I'm going to be kind of reading between the lines here a little bit, between verses 20 to 21. And this is, it's not really, I wouldn't call it really an appeal, but as the captains and the officers go out from the meeting with Pharaoh, they meet Moses and Aaron. And here's my assumptions. I think it is more likely that Moses and Aaron know they're in their meeting. Moses and Aaron are waiting to see the results, hoping that they will accomplish with Pharaoh what they had not been able to. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you're a kid, you say, you know, can Bobby go home with me tonight, spend the night? And they'll say, well, go ask your mama. Go ask your daddy. And you know, you're back in the background. They get back, what'd they say? What'd they say? You know, can you go? It's that kind of thing where except on a grown-up level, where the officers go to Pharaoh to appeal to him to give them some relief. And Moses and Aaron, who have already been rejected, are there waiting and hoping and praying that they were successful. Well, what happens? Verse 20, then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, the officers say to Moses and Aaron, let the Lord look on you and judge. That's enough to tell you things didn't go well, isn't it? Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us. They are all of a sudden a divided camp. The Israelite officers are now at odds with Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron, you had this brilliant idea to go out into the desert and to say you're going to lead us to Canaan, and it doesn't get to first base. Look what has happened. Pharaoh hates us. His officers hate us. We have been beaten. We have been killed. All because of this half-cocked plan of yours. How did Moses and Aaron respond? We don't see any response, at least not to the officers. We doesn't see that they talked to them at all. Perhaps they did. Who knows? But we don't see a response there. But here's what happens next. This is the last appeal. Moses goes alone, gets alone with God. And Moses said, oh God, where are we at? Why are we here? Why did you send me? What is going on? Let's read what he says in verse 22. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Do you know the answer to that question? I don't. I don't. Why is it, second question, why is it you have sent me? Same question, just on the other side of it happening that he asked in the desert, isn't it? The land of Midian. Why would you send me? Don't send, send somebody else. But now he's asking, why is it, did you send me? And look at verse 23. For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all. Moses is, you could describe his condition a lot of ways. You might say Moses is mad. Moses is angry. Maybe Moses is confused. Moses may be depressed. You could maybe use a lot of words to describe how Moses may feel. But Moses comes to God and he asks God these things. Do you remember what God told Moses to begin with? Flip back over to chapter 3, verse 18, so that we read, where we talked about that a while ago, where God told, here's what you're to tell Pharaoh. Let us go 3 days' journey to the wilderness so we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Then the next verse. This is God talking. But I am sure. God says, I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not even by a mighty hand. God told Moses this was going to happen, didn't he? But still, Moses is shocked. Moses is disappointed that God hasn't come through. And God told him he's not going to let you go. Are you like that? Man, I am. God never promises us a good life, does he? Does he promise you that you'll be a millionaire? You haven't heard the wealth and health and wealth prosperity here at this church. You haven't heard that. And my demeanor is such that I don't believe it. If you're around me very long, you'll know that. But sometimes I expect God to be good to me. I expect because I try to be a Christian. I try to live right. I try to do the right things. I try to pray when we have meals. I try to do all these things, and with those things that I do for God, I have expectations. Now I know, theologically, I know that's rubbish. That's foolish. But still, my practice tends to be that way. You know how I know that? Because every time something bad and uncomfortable hits me, I think, why me? What did I do? I know I've told you this before, but that was a little saying that we had on the job at work. You know, when you miscut a board, or you do something bad, or you hit your finger, or whatever. You know, I would say, why me? And Stephen McDaniel was working with me at the time, and he always had the ready response, why not you? And that is theologically sound. Why not me? There's all kinds of reasons God ought to judge me. There's all kinds of reasons God ought to punish me. Look at the last point, number six there, unrealized expectations. Did Moses know what Pharaoh's response would be? He should have. He should have known. It should not have surprised him. It should not have surprised the children of Israel, because surely Moses told them. God told me that he's not going to let you go, but God's going to strike him with a mighty hand. They wanted that mighty hand striking Pharaoh yesterday, didn't they? Did he communicate that to the people? I would think so. A low tolerance for suffering. That's me. I have a low tolerance for suffering. The placement of blame. Moses, the officers are blaming Moses and Aaron. And Aaron, in a sense, seems to be, or Moses, in a sense, seems to be blaming who? God. Now we're back to what I told you not to let me forget. Why did God do this way? Why did God just not when Moses got there, why did God not just strike Pharaoh off the face of the earth right then and they just walk out with no trouble? Why didn't God use that approach? It would have been cleaner. It would have looked nicer. They would have all been happy and lived ever after. Everything would have been really nice. Why didn't God do that? If he's not going to do that, why didn't he let Pharaoh cooperate? Why make it difficult? I don't know the answer to that, but I'll give you one thought, and then we're going to close. When the day came, when Pharaoh tells them, for the last time and for a sure time, get out. After the firstborn are dead, and Pharaoh says, get out. God lets Pharaoh go through all of this stuff, lets him refuse to let him go over and over and over again, and in the meantime, the Israelites are suffering and suffering and suffering. But when the day comes, when Pharaoh says, get out, there's one thing Pharaoh knows. I should have listened to God the first time. I should have done what he said. Pharaoh tends to be just like we are. We are headstrong. We are stubborn. We want our cake and we want to eat it too. We want all of these things and we want things our way. And if we're not careful, we will resist God to try to get them. Now you may look at me and say, I have never done that. You are a fooling yourself. I started to say you're a fool, but to say you are fooling yourself, you have done it. You didn't call it that, but you've done it. You have tried to have your own way when you knew as well as daylight is from dark, that God, that was not what God wanted you to do. Misery awaits. Hardship awaits. This is the first meeting, the first approach. You see the outline, trying the tactful approach. Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh and try to be nice. Try to just ask him, let us go. All right? And this may be part of this other deal that we talked about all ago that I don't have the answers to. They didn't tell Pharaoh, we're going to Canaan, and adios, amigo, we won't be back. You won't ever see us again. We're tired of being your slaves. They didn't say that. They told this little line, we're going to go out in the wilderness and worship. They tried to be nice. They tried to just ask permission. They said, please. It didn't work. They tried the tactful approach. Things are going to start getting rougher, aren't they? Let's pray. God, I want to say that you have tried the tactful approach with me. It didn't work, and you have let your judgment fall upon me in harder and more coarser degrees. God, I have not experienced your judgment compared to what it could have been. It's almost like I've never experienced your judgment at all. You have been good. God, in the darkest days of my life, dark with my own sin, the darkest days of my life, you were laying a path of goodness for me. God, you have been good. Lord, I praise you. I worship you, a God who loves me. God, how good you are. Amen.